Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
For those of you who have been paying very, very close attention to the show and listening to it regularly, then you'll remember 3 months ago we had a talk about or a chat about some science showing you should be careful consuming politically divisive information because when you consume that via the internet, could have an effect on your relationship.
This was the UK.
This was the UK specifically, combination of, it was Max Planck research, also done with an Italian university.
It had to do with Brexit and whether, or what happens to a couple, the health of a relationship when Brexit is discussed? Or
specifically, imagine a couple, a British couple,
yeah,
and they are sitting down to have dinner. And one of them firmly believes that the UK should have stayed in the EU.
Yeah.
That this would be a remain position, that should have remained. And the other one says, no, it should have left.
What happens
exited
to that?
And obviously, they're probably not explicitly discussing this at every meal.
Yeah.
But if those are their two opinions, what happens to that couple? And the data was very clear that if you had two people sitting down who both agreed that it should, for example, should have remained in the EU, that there's a 0.9% chance that they would divorce. I mean, there's always a chance any relationship is going to fail for a variety of reasons. So 0.9%. But if one says leave and the other says remain, it jumps to 1.8%, the chance that they would divorce. So it has doubled. That was based on 40,000 people, kind of two different studies looking at the same thing, but 40,000 people.
And now you've got research out of the United States, is that right?
Yes. Kind of an update. It's really a few months later, an update looking at the same idea very differently. Instead of 40,000 participants, this is 28.
Oh.
That's a big difference. That's a very small number, so small that some people might say, does this study have any relevance at all? And that's a fair question to ask anytime, especially when the study itself is qualitative and not quantitative. It's not looking at data. It's talking to people.
The way that data is expressed, yeah.
Yeah. And in this case, in this particular case, the study is called, by the way, before I forget, Negotiating Reality, How Much Mis- or Disinformation Shapes Romantic Relationships, published in New Media and Society Journal. They were just asking people whose relationships had failed what happened and whether there was a political dimension to that failing. And a couple examples, all sorts of examples. Obviously, a qualitative study like this one is going to interview people. And one of them called himself Adam. That's not his real name. He describes himself as a libertarian, somebody who supports or subscribes to the idea of the smallest possible government or no government at all, nearly. At that time, or at the time that he was interviewed, or prior to him being interviewed, was with a girlfriend who was left-leaning, in quotation marks. This is his description. And then during COVID-19, he and she had very, very different political opinions. He was convinced that his girlfriend was consuming mainstream media propaganda. I'm putting those in quotation marks for anyone who can't see.
Yeah.
And hence her decision to vaccinate, to get vaccinated against the novel coronavirus, was based on nonsense. This was his opinion. Meanwhile, he was turning to places like YouTube, where he would look at people who were also libertarians, listen to them, and get his opinions. And at that time, I think he's since shifted, but at that time he would have said, he would have argued that that one shouldn't do that. Now, again, we've said this many times on the show. There's overwhelming evidence that COVID-19 vaccines have saved possibly hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of lives. I don't have that number in front of me right now. Yeah, but this was a huge fundamentally political divide between them, and they broke up.
And the researchers were looking into why they broke up, or these 28 different people that they were looking at, they were looking at what exactly?
Yeah. What caused it? If you look back on it, what was the moment, or what was the splinter or the fracture that became a chasm that in the end couldn't be bridged? And they had only been together, that couple, Adam and his girlfriend, had only been together a couple months.
No, and this research is important because now you have a qualitative look of the consequences of that kind of behavior. What can happen if you or your partner go down this rabbit hole, and what it does to the relationship, in addition to the quantitative data that we got out of the UK, which you talked about 3 weeks ago. Now we're going to go 3 years ago.
Whoa!
Do you remember when we published an episode called The Future of Pregnancy, mm-hmm. where we listened to a researcher from Caltech who had, at that point, recently created an embryo. This was a mouse embryo in a lab.
Mm-hmm.
And the question at that point was, I believe, posed by a colleague of ours. That whole discussion happened because we met a female colleague of ours, Celia, and they were discussing the idea of do we need men then if this mouse embryo could be created from two females, do we need men?
It was a sci-fi theoretical. Yeah, if you had a planet populated by one biological sex, either all male or all female, which would survive better and why? Would it be possible to have births on new human beings created on both of those separate planets?
Yeah.
And the answer there was probably yes, that it would probably work under certain circumstances for both of those planets to keep repopulating.
There is an update in this field. Out of the University of Oregon, a proof of concept study has just been published where they created an embryo. It's a little bit like Dolly the Sheep. Dolly the Sheep was created by taking the nucleus out of a cell and putting it into an egg cell. So you've got the DNA of two mothers that created a clone. This is not a clone, so you're taking material from a male and a female, but the female isn't providing an egg on her own. The egg is being essentially assembled or created. And this would be a way to get around IVF. If you have a person who wants to get pregnant and IVF doesn't work, with this method, it could work. At this point, this didn't. The researchers said, look, we stopped after 6 days. They created 82 eggs this way, and 8 of them got through the critical 3 days of after fertilization and became blastocysts.
Mm-hmm.
And after 6 days, they stopped culturing because it's unethical at this point. Because you could create a baby. They said it wouldn't happen because they doctored the egg in a certain way that the chromosomes, there were chromosomal deficiencies. And what they did to create this egg was they subjected it to an electrical shock and gave it a drug that would induce meiosis, or the dividing of the cell. Because when you get chromosomes from the skin cell, there are already 46 in those. Normally, you get 23 chromosomes from each, and they combine to form the blastocyst and the zygote, and then everything is normal. In this case, you've got a cell that already has the 46 chromosomes, so you've got an extra set. And what they had to do was try and get rid of that set by inducing meiosis, which is cell division. But at this point, they don't know enough to do it correctly. And they're saying that that's the future research for this. Once they find out how to do that better, people won't need IVF. You can create an egg on your own with just the nucleus from a skin cell, which is incredibly scary.
Wild.
But an unbelievable breakthrough.
Wild. At this point. Yeah, that sounds like science fiction. And for now,
it's not at this point. At this point, it's not.
The end goal remains for now. But
3 years ago, when we published that, The Future of Pregnancy, we were talking with that Caltech researcher, and it had this science fiction feel to it back then. But now, according to these researchers in Oregon, this is very real. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go into space and away from that. That does like a micro universe to the smallest levels, now to the biggest level.
Okay.
And keep this very short, because most people aren't as fascinated by astronomy as I am. They just aren't. That's a fact. I love
it. You're the number one astronomer in my world. I don't know anyone who likes this stuff more than you.
So I'm just going to keep this short and sweet. European Space Agency announcing that a telescope, the Gaia telescope, named after the Greek goddess of the Earth, which has not, kind of oddly, not been aimed at our Earth, the opposite, our galaxy. That's what it's been looking at, or had been looking at till it was decommissioned, but for a long time. Beautiful data, incredible stars moving all around, and this is maybe the biggest picture, meaning imagine you're looking at our galaxy, the Milky Way from the outside, and everyone knows it has this disc shape that's thicker in the center, and then it goes outward and gets thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. The new discovery is that there's an aberration, if you're looking at this disc from the side, on both sides in a wave. There's a wave rippling through our galaxy.
And you can see it?
You can see it on both sides, yeah. Which is interesting because you have to, you, obviously, we don't have a telescope outside of the Milky Way looking in. We can't, we're nowhere near that. So this is based on data from within, but just looking at everything from within, we can see that we have a ripple. It goes up, if you can visually imagine this, the ripple kind of spikes up on the left and kind of spikes down on the right. It's as if you've tossed a pebble in the water, yeah, and you're seeing ripples on still water to the left and to the right.
And what does this mean? Where are the ripples coming from?
That was my question. It took a long time reading the European Space Agency's article to get to that. Why on earth did a star go supernova right toward the middle? And is it, if it's equidistant on both sides, then it must have been the middle, right? So they have two possibilities or two hypotheses. One is that a past collision with a dwarf galaxy could be a possible explanation. Some of you out there might know that we are on a collision course with a different galaxy right now, the Andromeda Galaxy. We're going to fly through each other. Collision is kind of the wrong word. There is so much space between stars. We're going to fly through each other, but the gravitational forces will just kind of rip things into different directions. That's one of them. The other that they postulate is the Great Wave could also be related to a smaller scale rippling motion seen 500 light years from the sun. That's not that far away. If you're looking at the belt of Orion, 500 light years away is between us and that belt. And it extends over 9,000 light years, the so-called Radcliffe Wave. All I want to leave you with is just the image. It's like a frisbee, our galaxy, except the frisbee ripples upward, yeah, on the left and ripples downward on the right. Something did that. We're trying to figure out what, but that is new information that we now know.
That I can take with me to my next cocktail party when I'm hanging out at the where you get a drink. Hey, did you know that?
Well, no.
Did you know that our galaxy has ripples?
You don't do it like that. You wait until somebody mentions something thematically connected or related to it, so that you can come in with your novel piece of information that and segue to it casually as if it's no big deal. That's how you do it socially, my man.
You've got
more science right at the end.
Do I? One little quick one. Okay, so this study was specifically done on people with a chronic debilitating lung condition, but it's not only for people with COPD, and they were looking at 100 people. This was in Australia, University of Monash and Cambridge University. And the reason I like this study is that it can apply to everyone, because they split these 100 people who are suffering from COPD into two groups. One group got normal medical treatment. The other group got normal medical treatment and had to do a 12-week singing class.
Whoa. Okay.
And they measured their well-being. So not only how they're doing, but also their well-being. For the people in the singing class, their well-being skyrocketed.
Oh, but, okay.
And yes, it's an online singing class, 12 sessions where they sang with other people online. And despite their COPD, which is just trouble breathing, it just follows you everywhere you go. It's incurable. It improved their well-being. So I just wanted to mention that. I just found that really cool.
And did it do anything for their physiological health?
Yeah. There is possibly something about singing that is good for your airwaves, for your respiration, for whatever it is that leads to the affliction of COPD.
I've been saying to you for years that for all of you who have a smartwatch or if you track your athletic activities in any way using a phone or a watch, that I think missing from that list is singing as a physical athletic activity. It is exhausting. It is. There's no way that's not a workout, and yet it's not typically listed as a workout. So it wouldn't surprise me that has a physiological benefit somehow. Mm. But then also, it sounds like here specifically with this disease. What is COPD? Just real quick at the end.
So that stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. A guy that works with my brother has it. Sits all day long on his riding rough mower and coughs and smokes, and that would probably be one thing to mention at this point. If you have it, please quit smoking, because it's chronic and it's just debilitating.
That's it for now. Sing. Based on that study alone, although I guess to be very specific, sing with other people online. Gabe, you and I have tried that in the past with our colleagues for various celebrations here at DW. It sounded terrible. Awful. There's a slight lag between when I say something and when others hear it, and then they try. That's
no, it was for a festive Christmas party, and just, it just sucked.
Yeah, we told
try singing Silver Bells when you say silver, and by the time you hear bells already, yeah. it's just all over the place.
No. So there are limitations in some ways there. Our galaxy has ripples going outward. Very important information to some of you. Not too many of you, but to some of you. Also, be aware that when you're consuming political information on your phone that's pushing you in one direction, you might also be destroying your relationship.
And at this point, embryos can be created by two males or two females.
What do you think about that?
It doesn't matter anymore. Nothing matters anymore.
What are you going to do with that information? Let us know. SU@DW.com. Probably seen some of the romance movies that I have, where after a tumultuous getting to know each other and they date for a while. I was going to say Bridget Jones. That's the first one that comes to mind. But there are a lot of romance movies where it ends, or one of the climactic scenes is the wedding and the violin music and the flower petals and.
The implication is gigantic that this is going to be huge, tremendously important for the life satisfaction of those two people getting married.
You see it in their eyes.
This is going to make their lives way more satisfying.
And unfortunately, new data based on Germans and people from the UK says that is absolutely not true.
Scripted.
All right, great. So, hi, my name is Usama El Awad. I'm a researcher in the field of developmental psychology at the University of Bielefeld. And together with my colleagues, I published the paper called Mapping Life Satisfaction Over the First Years of Cohabitation Among Formal Singles Living Alone in UK and Germany, that has been published in the Journal of Personality. Yes.
Usama, if there was one big takeaway from your study, one big conclusion that kind of got everyone talking, what would you say that is?
Life satisfaction, I mean, the increase in life satisfaction is happening in the beginning of a partnership, when you get to know to your partner and you enter the relationship. So the relationship formation, that is associated with the biggest increase in life satisfaction. And all other transitions, like moving in together, marriage did not add meaningfully to life satisfaction beyond being partnered and living together in one household.
I guess what surprises me here is that there are other studies that show that, you know, being married to someone obviously has practical benefits, or moving in with someone. You're sharing your resources, you're possibly ultimately paying off the place that you live in. Practical benefits everywhere. However, it doesn't lead to more life satisfaction. That forces me to ask you now, what is that then? What is life satisfaction?
Yeah. We look at the overall evaluation of the current life as a whole. So each year, participants answered the single question, how satisfied are you with your life in general? And so we are talking about life satisfaction that covers all areas of life, and which is not specified into, for example, sexual satisfaction or relationship satisfaction. So we are talking about the overall, the general life satisfaction at this point.
And as a psychologist, can you surmise why this might be the case? What could be the psychological reason for why marriage doesn't do anything to my overall life satisfaction? Because like Connor said before, it is a really important event, but it doesn't do anything to my happiness. That That's a little strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But it's not that strange if you just consider also the financial struggle that a marriage nowadays is associated with, or if you just consider that, the symbolic meaning of that event is also shifting. And so I'm not sure how to word it in English, but in German we say giving the yes word. So that act of giving the yes word, that is not that important for people nowadays anymore, as it has been in earlier decades.
Is it okay if I ask you a personal question?
Yes, of course.
Okay. You look to me like you're a young man, so I'm just going to ask your age and marital status, Usama.
All right. So I'm not yet married, but I plan to marry soon. For me personally, the step itself is less important than the possibilities it can open up. And I can say that it's the same for my partner. You see, that aligns perfectly with our findings. I mean, today marriage may be less a renewed assurance of relationship quality and more a formal legal step, one that can unlock practical advantages in daily life.
And so based on your data, your recommendation to our listeners is, I mean, if our listeners are really paying attention, the message is clear. Take off your rings, chuck them in the ocean, or the dumpster, and then go out and start a new relationship, what, every 3 to 6 months or 9 months? That would give you the biggest life satisfaction hit, even if it's temporary?
Yeah, so my recommendations are, first, focus on building a stable relationship, of course. See cohabitation as a stabilizer, not a magic fix, probably. Don't feel pressure to marry for happiness or for life satisfaction.
Yeah, but if I want that boost in life satisfaction, then I want to go and get a new partner because the boost comes at the beginning. And I get that boost and then I move on to a new partner and get another boost. And I just keep boosting all the way up until I'm like really satisfied.
No, I think that's not what is meant here. So all our participants, they were single, living alone in the first year. In the second year, they found a partner and moved in together with that partner, or they moved in together with that partner in the following year. Then they lived with that partner up to 2 years and potentially got married with that partner. So you have the whole course and not multiple partners or something that is interrupting that course.
Is another way of looking at this, Usama, that the change, I mean, is kind of logical, because for a long time when society was more conservative, you weren't living with your partner necessarily before you got married. In fact, you might have married them so young that the idea of living together for a while wasn't even possible. So back then, that marriage would have been huge. You marry them and move in with them all at once. It's this huge thing. And now it's like we're getting married in what, our mid-30s maybe, after living together for 6 years. And it's just like, eh?
Exactly. In former times, or in earlier decades, marriage was the central, the most important social commitment to a partnership. And nowadays, it symbolized commitment and stability in the partnership. And nowadays, it is not like that anymore. So moving in together is associated with practical advantage nowadays, or more practical advantage. You have like shared costs, for example, or you have more time that you spend with your partner. You have better possibilities to plan together. And it even replaces the marriage for a lot of people nowadays.
And that was Usama Al-Awad, a developmental psychology researcher from Bielefeld, up just north of us here in Germany.
Yeah. We asked him a personal question there, Connor, and I think at this point we probably have to get personal with a topic like this. Because we kind of fit I certainly fit that type who has married after living together with someone for a long time. I met Adrienne in 2007. We moved in pretty quickly by the end of that year. And then we lived together. We cohabitated for, I don't know, 10 years before we got married.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And you are kind of the opposite. You guys got married relatively early on?
We were, let's see, we were married within 4 years, like exactly 4 years after starting to live. Well, fewer than 4 years, yeah.
Okay.
Although I would say I don't know if your experience matches what he's saying, but I would have argued, that's why I found this study interesting. I would have said that there was a life satisfaction.
I would have said that too.
Benefit. I still kind of believe that despite this research. And my personal take on that is just the somewhere in me, I guess, was a fear or the question, is this relationship going to work? Is this person going to leave me? Is this thing going to fall apart for some reason that I'm not even aware of yet? And by marrying those, they never totally vanish, but they certainly... I don't know. Things are far more settled. You don't have to worry. I didn't worry about that as much. I don't worry about that as much. It felt way more secure.
And that is an important factor in your overall well-being, your life satisfaction. Your life is more satisfying knowing that your relationship is more stable?
Well, I don't know that's where you get into whether, you know, the survey asking you about life satisfaction really nails it. Is that what I consider life satisfaction when that word comes
my way?
It's
one factor?
It is. Yeah. So I would tend to think... And especially in the immediate aftermath of that marriage, I would have been like, "Oh yeah, I used to be a 6 or a 7 out of 10, and I'm up to 8." Yeah. Did you?
I mean, yeah, my life was on the rocks for a long time. We had a good run of it, 10 years. But when we got married, it wasn't as stable as it had been, and then it led to, I would say, overall more stability. But I wouldn't say that that's the reason why getting married made me more satisfied. I like calling Adrienne my wife.
Really?
In German.
Oh, I hate that word.
My woman. Meine Frau.
That's my woman.
There's something about that. There's something about
it. Meine Frau.
I like that. That's my woman. I'm her man.
This is my man.
I like that. It's way better than in German. You say friend. That's my Freund.
Oh, yeah. My boyfriend or girlfriend.
See that?
My friend.
That didn't do it for me. That didn't satisfy me.
You wanted...
When she calls me her man, that's something cool. And then it came kind of at the same time we got a house, we got a dog. Like, I feel pretty solid right now with regard to satisfaction. And marriage played a very decent role in that, I think.
How do you all feel? I guess this is these are our two personal takes on it. You most certainly have your own, and I would love to read those, actually. Please, su@dw.com.
Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.